From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Brands you'll like at prices you'll love. That's the slogan of Kohl's department store. They're now the target of anti-sweatshop activists. Today we'll talk with union organizers from the Free Trade Zone in Nicaragua. Also, a look at a number of stories in the Middle East. The U.S. is beating the war drum again against Iraq, and the West Bank flares up. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Policy Institute today released the results of its latest study, which found that Texas now leads the United States in incarceration levels. The Texas prison system grew faster than any other prison system in the country during the 1990s, adding nearly one out of every five prisoners to the nation's prison boom. The criminal justice think tank found that one out of every 20 adults in Texas is either in prison, jail, on probation, or on parole. Texas now has the dubious distinction of having the largest prison population in the country, surpassing the prison population of California, which has 13 million more citizens than Texas. The study also found that African Americans in Texas are incarcerated at seven times the rate of whites, and nearly one in three young African American men in Texas is under some form of criminal justice control. The incarceration rate for blacks in Texas is 63% higher than the national incarceration rate for blacks. Standing alone amongst the states, Texas's nonviolent prison population represents the second largest incarcerated population in the country after California and is larger than the entire prisoner population of Britain, a country of 60 million people. These Justice Policy Institute findings come as the Justice Department yesterday reported that violent crime dropped 10% over the last year in the U.S. This news from Colombia: two separate massacres have left at least seven people dead there. Officials blame right-wing paramilitary militias for one attack. Gunmen killed seven people and left the bodies along a road. The killers painted nearby buildings with the initials of a paramilitary umbrella group. In the other attack, gunmen seized, interrogated, and then executed 10 residents of two poor neighborhoods in the Caribbean coastal town of Cienaga. Police are still investigating the massacre. The attacks come 3 days before President Clinton visits Colombia to discuss U.S. anti-drug aid. Human rights groups are urging Clinton to withhold the aid until Colombia's president takes firmer action to stop the paramilitary forces. The South China Morning Post reports today that toys sold with McDonald's meals in Hong Kong are being made at a mainland China sweatshop that's illegally employing child labor. The paper says children as young as 14 work 16-hour days for about $3. In a statement, McDonald's says, quote, it will not... for a boycott of McDonald's. This news from Richmond, Virginia. Black farmers say the government has been stingy and slow about issuing payments from last year's settlement of a lawsuit alleging decades of racial discrimination in federal lending practices. The U.S. Department of Agriculture won court approval in April 1999 for the settlement suit filed on behalf of black farmers who claim they've been systematically discriminated against for years when they applied for loans and subsidy programs. And the number of FBI intelligence officers has grown almost fivefold during the Clinton administration, this according to Syracuse University Research Center. FBI Director Louis Free has stated that the Bureau is putting top priority on thwarting foreign spies and preventing terrorist attacks, but hard data about the change and emphasis have been sparse because so many of the operations are classified. And this news from Knoxville, Tennessee. The sign out front said, buy a car, get a gun. The controversial gun giveaway at a Tennessee auto dealership Saturday attracted lots of attention and new gun club memberships. Three customers bought a vehicle and accepted a voucher for a free deer hunting rifle valued at $100. Gun opponents say the giveaway was irresponsible, but the dealership's owner tells the Knoxville News Sentinel that nobody bought a car just to get a rifle. He calls the giveaway icing on the cake. Auto dealer Greg Lumpy Lambert says the media attention was well worth the trouble. Yesterday, members of the Bath Ironworks' largest union in Maine showed what they thought of the shipyard's last contract proposal by piling up their copies and setting them on fire. Then they voted to strike. Pickets today went up at the shipyard for the first time in 15 years following a resounding union vote against a contract offer for 4,800 employees. The current contract expired at midnight, shutting down production at one of only two Navy shipyards that build Aegis destroyers. The last strike at Bath Ironworks, a subsidiary of General Dynamics, was a 99-day walkout in 1985.
I've always hated Blockbuster.
Target.
The Gap.
Pepsi. IBM.
Starbucks. Not quite so much. If I'm not boycotting at least three oil companies, I start to feel out of touch. I wouldn't be seen near Nordstrom or any such. And I hate Walmart. I don't like whips. I don't like chains. I don't go chopping up my neighbor's brains. Don't really even like shopping except at the flea market. I hate Walmart. Now you may wonder, what's all this fuss? If you don't like the train, take the bus. Well, I found religion, and just between us, I hate Walmart. Company sell the low cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart. Used to be you drive around, stop in on three or four towns, encounter different sights and sounds, different if not unique. Different accent, different smells, different things to buy and sell. Now it's all Taco Bell.
Dave Littman, his CD, I Hate Walmart. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we're not talking about Walmart today, but another major chain of department stores. For the past 2 weeks, activists from the National Labor Committee have been traveling across the country demonstrating against the Kohl's department store chain, which is headquartered outside Milwaukee, Wisconsin. These demonstrations immediately followed the deportation of Charles Kernighan of the National Labor Committee, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of Detroit, and other anti-sweatshop activists from Managua, Nicaragua. The group spent 4 days interviewing workers of the Chentex and Mil Colores sweatshops, which produce blue jeans for Kohl's, as well as Kmart, Walmart, and JCPenney. Today we're joined by Charles Kernighan, head of the National Labor Committee for Human Rights, which is based in New York, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of Detroit, as well as two workers from the plants and the free trade zones in Nicaragua, our guests from Nicaragua. Include two young women who've been organizing at the plants. Gladys Del Carmen Manzanares is General Secretary of the Chentex Workers Union, fired for union activity, and Rosa Esterlino Campo Gonzalez is Labor Secretary with the Mil Colores Workers Union, also fired for her union activity. Charles Kernighan, let's start with you. First of all, for people outside of the Midwest, where Kohl's is very big, Kohl's, by the way, named for Senator Herbert Kohl's family, which started the chain. Can you tell us the significance of Kohl's department stores?
Well, Kohl's is booming. They're located in the Midwest, but they have a great expansion going on, 60 new stores a year. They're expanding into the Northeast. They'll be opening several stores on Long Island on October 6th. They're opening stores in New Jersey. So Kohl's is about $4.6 billion in sales. Their profits last year were up 34%. They made $258 million. And their CEO, Mr. Kellogg, paid himself $38 million last year. And yet this whole struggle in Nicaragua boils down to an 8-cent wage increase. The workers are currently paid, and we have the piece rates. They've smuggled the piece rate data out of the factory, so it's not speculation. This isn't black and white. This is the company data. There are 38 steps to sew a pair of jeans, and they break each step down into 10 thousandths of a cent. So for all 38 steps, it comes to 2.574 cordobas, or less than 20 cents. So the workers are currently paid 20 cents for every pair of pants they make. They're living in utter misery. And what they wanted to negotiate with the company, with the Kohl's contractor called Chentex and at Milklers, they wanted to negotiate an 8-cent wage increase to bring the total labor cost to sew the pants up to 28 cents. Because of that, the contractor fired hundreds of workers, including all the union leaders, and it's bringing bogus criminal charges against the union leaders, which can land them in prison for 7 to 20 years. They put barbed wire up around the factory, installed surveillance cameras, brought in thugs, and the contractor said to the workers, your union is dead and you'll never get a wage increase from us. They formed a company union, and then the Taiwanese-owned company turned to the government of Nicaragua and said, if you don't let us fire the workers, we're going to pull out of Nicaragua. Not just the Chentex factory, but all the Taiwanese investments. And so they blackmailed the government of Nicaragua in broad daylight, and the government gave the green light so that now hundreds of workers have been fired and blacklisted because they asked for an 8-cent wage increase to climb out of misery.
If the Taiwanese companies were to pull out of Nicaragua, what kind of effect would that have? How powerful are they there?
Well, Taiwan is enormously powerful in Nicaragua. The government of Taiwan has built the presidential palace. It has built the Ministry of Labor. It has built the foreign ministry. And it has rebuilt and refurbished the National Assembly. So Taiwan has this enormous power. And what we're seeing is that these Taiwanese companies actually follow U.S. trade bills. So, for example, with CBI parity, with the Caribbean Basin Initiative, with the CBI parity, which is going to expand NAFTA benefits to Central America and the Caribbean, lifting all quotas and tariff on garments made in Central America and the Caribbean, which are exported to the U.S. By the way, that'll put $200 million a year into the pockets of Kohl's and other companies, the reduced tariffs. So they have three factories. This one Chentex conglomerate has three factories in Nicaragua, but they wouldn't pull out. It's all a bluff. It's all a bluff. What they're about is that the workers, when they try to organize to defend their most basic dignity and decency, they are going to be crushed.
Gladys Del Carmen Manzanares, General Secretary of the Chentex Workers Union. When were you fired? By the way, Gladys is being translated by Barbara Briggs of the National Labor Committee.
Since the 2nd of May.
You were fired. Why?
Porque se hizo una protesta de unos 50 minutos.
A 50-minute protest work stoppage.
Porque teníamos 8 meses de estar negociando.
Because we've been trying to negotiate a wage increase for 8 months.
Y no nos querían aumentar salario.
And they were not willing to give us a wage increase. So it was a measure to pressure the company. But their response instead was to fire the 11 union leaders. And then 600 workers.
Do you work at the plant? Did you work at the plant?
Yes, I worked as an operator, as a sewing operator.
Uh-huh. What did you sew?
Well, I did back pockets. I knew how to do all the operations. But mostly back pockets.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved with the union?
Well,
on seeing that there was too much mistreatment, screaming, they pulled their hair. They'd even slap workers, pull their ears, take the pants, and throw them in the worker's face. It was too much. It just really bothered you, hurt you too much, and the workers couldn't bear it. So that's why we decided to make a union.
Claro, que aprovechamos cuando llegó Charlie
we took advantage when Charlie and Hard Copy came.
Entonces, los chinos estaban un poco medio así, como miedosos.
The Chinese at that moment were a little bit, well, fearful.
Sí, fue una denuncia que dilató una semana en los medios de comunicación.
And there was a press denunciation for a whole entire week in the media in Nicaragua.
Entonces, aprovechamos para hacer
so we took advantage to create the union. Then in 1998,
hicimos muchos cambios.
We made a lot of changes.
Hubo respeto para los trabajadores.
There was respect for the workers.
Pero cuando solicitamos el aumento de salario, ya ellos
but then when
cambiaron.
We asked for a wage increase, they changed.
Sí, y ya empezaron otra vez a presionar duro.
And again, they started to pressure the workers really hard.
Después que nos despidieron,
and in addition to firing us,
hicieron a los trabajadores renunciar a la fuerza.
They forced workers to quit.
Les decían, si
they
no
said,
te vas,
if you
si
don't
no
go,
renuncia,
if you don't quit, we'll fire you with Article 48.
El 48 el artículo 48 significa que el trabajador
Article
se va
48,
sin real.
Firing for cause means the worker goes with nothing, with no money, no severance.
Entonces, si ponía su renuncia, le daban
so,
su indemnización del tiempo trabajado.
If you put in your resignation, then they'd give you severance pay.
How much did people make an hour? And is it mainly women, girls?
Sí, la mayoría son
yes,
jóvenes,
the majority are young,
entre 18
women,
y 25, 30
between 18 and 28, maybe 30 years old at the most.
Y el pago es de 800 córdobas mensuales.
Is 800 córdobas a month, that's the base wage.
Y unos $65.
About $65 a month.
Y tenía que, para ganar más, tenía que hacer muchas horas extra.
To earn more, you had to do a lot of overtime.
Porque ahí era donde el trabajador lograba sacar un poco más.
Because that way the worker was able to earn a little bit more in wage.
Pero también
but
el maltrato era lo que
the
no
mistreatment
se
was just
sí,
not bearable.
Presión.
Too much pressure.
Si el trabajador trabaja demasiado tensionado, con
the worker
mucho temor,
worked just too, they were too tense, they were too
sí.
afraid because
y
the workers were
adelante,
right on top of them,
uno,
in front of you, behind you.
Es más, también a la salida registran a los trabajadores.
Not only more, not only that, but as at the exit, then they would search the workers physically.
Y si la mujer anda con su menstruación,
for instance, if a woman was having her period,
sienten algo el,
they'd
el
feel something.
Registra.
They'd search you and they'd feel something. And then they'd put you in a little room to take your shirt off, make you pick your pants or your skirt down to show what you're carrying.
Sí. Entonces, por esa razón hicimos el sindicato.
That's why we made the union.
Para que se nos defiendan nuestros derechos,
to defend our rights, our human and our labor rights.
Rosa Estelino Ocampo Gonzalez, you're with Mil Colores Workers Union, which is another plant. It also makes clothes for Kohl's in addition to the other stores.
Sí, yo soy ex trabajadora de la empresa
Mil Colores. I'm an ex-worker of the Mil Colores company, which is North American property. The company specializes in jeans and shorts, pants, shorts and pants. We produce for Kohl's, Targets, other stores. Mm-hmm.
And what was the problem in your plant? How much were women making at the plant?
Bueno, el básico de la
is 800 cordobas, which is $65. But per hour, it was 30 cents an hour. But in that company, they didn't even pay our base wage.
What do you mean they didn't even pay it? Why not?
A nosotros pues allá no nos pagaban semanal.
Well, they pay us per week.
Y en el pago de nosotros devengábamos, en los pagos salían de 200 córdobas.
We would earn 200, 300 córdobas.
Como alrededor de cuántos dólares.
600 mensual.
Sí.
Which would come to about which would come to about 600.
¿Cuánto vale en dólares quincenal? Como alrededor de 25, 30
like $25,
$30
we'd earn.
Y cuando sacábamos los $30 semanal era porque teníamos que hacer, nos quedábamos en toda la semana
and
desde 5 a 7 de la noche.
And if we earned $30 in a week, it was because we were staying from 5 to 7 working overtime hours every single night.
And the conditions in the plant.
Bueno, las condiciones de trabajo son pésimas.
Well, the working conditions are horrible.
No, no, nos trataban de estúpidos.
They called us stupid, animal.
They
throw the pants in our faces. If there was a little a mistake or a pick or a problem on the piece, they'd threaten us.
Did you have
try to work better? We're going to fire you. We're going to send you to the street.
Did you have breaks in the day? Could you go to the bathroom?
Well, we could only go to the bathroom maybe once a day as far as they were concerned. Because if we went twice or three times in the day, then they'd give us a warning or sometimes would fire you. Also, the bathrooms always smelled really bad. There was no soap, no toilet paper, and they measure the time to go to the bathroom. If we delayed 2 or 3 minutes, they knocked on the door of the bathroom to make us get out and said, we have to go back to work. Our machine was waiting for us.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to find out what kind of effort is being made here in the United States. I know you've been traveling around the country speaking with students groups, with unions, and are putting pressure on Kohl's, which I understand had some people arrested at a recent protest. Kohl's department store, which is expanding their stores around the country, based in the Midwest, actually based in Wisconsin. You are listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! But back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we learn about the situation of subcontractors, clothing manufacturers in Nicaragua that make clothing for a number of department chains in the United States, including Walmart, Kmart, and we are looking at Kohl's department store, which is based in Wisconsin, which is opening up new stores around the country. At the plants we're looking at, workers are paid less than 1% of the sale price of the garments they make. U.S. companies and their contractors using their economic power as leverage to create a race to the bottom in developing countries. Charlie Kernighan, you're head of the National Labor Committee. You went down to Nicaragua bringing to light the stories that we're hearing now of two of the workers who've been fired for organizing, Rosa Estelina Ocampo Gonzalez of the Mil Colores Workers Union and Gladys del Carmen Manzanares of the Chentex Workers Union, both fired for union activity. By the way, Rosa, was it you who was fired saying that you had a weapon, brought a weapon into the plant?
Well, we were fired because we wanted to organize. We tried to organize a union in the factory to defend our rights as the human beings and the people that we are. Mr. Greg Miller accuses us of criminal charges. He's accusing all of us compañeros, all of us union leaders, because we did a work stoppage together with all of the workers to press them to reinstate all of the members of the executive board. We didn't bring mortars or anything like that.
They said you brought a rocket launcher.
They say so, but this is a lie. Like all of the charges that Mr. Greg is accusing us of, it's tactics. Greg's tactics.
Charles Kernighan, you've been to a lot of plants in Central America. Is this unusual, seeing these union organizers who were fired now being charged with criminal charges?
No, sadly, it's not unusual. But to see this factory surrounded by barbed wire and the surveillance cameras, with 600 to 700 workers fired from Chentex, 208 workers fired from Mil Colores, and the criminal charges are like illicit association to create a crime.
And
In other words, these are the charges there. And these are serious charges. These people could go to prison for 7 to 20 years.
And this is called a free trade zone?
This is a free trade zone where Kohl's and Walmart and their contractors pay no taxes. Not corporate tax, not income tax, not sales tax, zero. And in fact, members of the government, the Congress, could not even get into the zone. The head of the Human Rights Commission of the National Assembly went to the free trade zone, and he was turned away at gunpoint, and he was told, sorry, we can't let you in here because we cannot violate the rights of private property. So that's how these zones operate. And Kohl's, by the way, just to give a quick example, when these pants land in the United States, made in Nicaragua, when they land in Miami, the total cost of those pants is $7.15. That's the total cost. That's material, labor, shipping, profit to their contract at Chentex and Mil Colores, $7.15. Then Kohl's marks it up 420% and sells it for $30. But they don't have the 8 cents for the workers who are living in misery. And the same thing with the Kellogg's $38 million salary.
Bishop Gumbleton, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton, is joining us on the phone right now from Detroit. You went down to Nicaragua to investigate the human rights situation in these plants, is that right?
Yes, I went.
And when were you there?
Well, I guess it's about a week and a half ago now.
Uh-huh. And what did you find?
I found the things that Charlie was describing, a plant that looks like it's under siege. And I mean, it seems absurd that they have to put up all this barbed wire. They have to have guards at the gates, and they have surveillance cameras. And then you also find people living in terrible situations. We visited the barrios where the people live, the fired workers, who went into their homes. And they're very simple huts, very small, 10 by 10 maybe, and there might be 6, 7, 10 people trying to live in one of these very small huts. And they can't get enough, they don't have resources to buy sufficient food for their families. So you have children that are malnourished. You have a situation of desperation, just physical human desperation. Plus, some of the things that you heard from the workers about how they're treated with such contempt and disdain. They don't show any regard, any respect for the workers as people. And so it's an utterly deplorable situation. It's one that just is has to be condemned, and we have to do everything we can to change it.
Charles Kernighan, you were talking about setting up a kind of bus ad campaign that has to do with the huts of the workers.
Well, this idea actually comes from Bishop Gumbleton's group and the other religious people in Detroit. They found out that for $500 they could rent the back of a bus, a city bus, and they painted the back of the bus with a big statement about Walmart using sweatshops and help end child labor and sweatshop abuses, and they announced a big demonstration they're going to have on September 3rd. So we get a lot of our ideas from these groups on the ground, and they're going to be renting a helicopter and flying around Kohl's and Walmart. But, you asked a question about this union. Have we seen this in other places? This, to us, is really the face of the global economy in a nutshell, and it's very filthy, and it's very ugly. This is the strongest union I've ever seen, the Chentex Union and the Mil Colores Union, the strongest union I've seen in Latin America. They're incredibly brilliant and courageous. They continue to organize. If we let them go under, I think it's the end of the labor movement in Central America. So this is like the fight of a lifetime. We need to draw the line in the sand. They've destroyed 6 unions in Nicaragua, roughly within the last 6 months. And, of course, there are no unions in El Salvador or Guatemala in the Maquila. And unions are under attack in Honduras and in the Dominican Republic. We will look back upon this as a tremendous watershed moment. And they're doing a great job in Nicaragua. Despite the blacklisting, despite the criminal charges, they're organizing like crazy. We just need to accompany them in the United States. We need to take Kohl's and break Kohl's.
Where have you gone in the United States?
Well, with Gladys and Rosa, we've been on tour for the last 10 days, just zooming from New York to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where we showed up with 100 people from the United Steelworkers in front of a Kohl's opening, and we wrecked it. We went out to Eugene, Oregon, to be with the students. United Students Against Sweatshops. Then we came back to Milwaukee, the Kohl's headquarters. We sought a meeting. They wouldn't give it to us. We went from Milwaukee to Chicago to Detroit to Toledo to Cleveland to Pittsburgh.
What happened in Detroit? Did you go to the Kohl's store there?
Well, in Detroit, yes. We had a wonderful demonstration where we got there, and Kohl's doesn't play any games. So when we arrived at the Kohl's store.
With Bishop Gumbleton?
Yes, with Bishop Gumbleton and the Interreligious Task Force for Worker Rights and Worker Justice. When we got there, we saw a lot of police presence, maybe 10 police cars, and the police were lined up in front of the Kohl's, like blocking us, that we were going to try to crash into the Kohl's store. And we just walked slowly towards the store with a banner. And we had a hand-carried microphone, and we were just singing songs, very gently walking with the fathers and the Bishop Gumbleton and the nuns and other activists and Rosa and Glass. We walked towards the store, and they went completely crazy. And the manager ran out. She was a woman, and she had a very ugly face on. And she ran out at us, and she said, "Get off my sidewalk." We were right in front of the Kohl's, so we stepped up onto the sidewalk in front of the Kohl's. And she says, "Get off my sidewalk. We own the sidewalk." So we stepped back off the sidewalk, and another guy runs over, and he says, "Get off my mall. I own this mall." So we step back onto the sidewalk. Then we step back, and they're screaming at us, "Get off my sidewalk. Get off the mall." And there was a priest there, Father Norm Thomas, and he was so smooth the way he handled this thing. And the police kept saying, "We're going to arrest you. We're going to arrest you. You have to leave. You have to leave." So we decided to walk backwards very, very slowly. And we started to go backwards. And with the microphone and the banner, we were denouncing Kohl's sweatshops. The fact that women couldn't buy milk for their kids because they were paid such starvation wages. And all they want is an 8-cent wage increase so they could climb out of misery into poverty. We're talking about the diets of the workers, the living conditions. And, of course, the media came because there was a controversy. Here was the police. We were nearly arrested. It was like a home run, a grand slam. It was a nightmare for Kohl's.
Bishop Gumbleton, has Kohl's gotten in touch with you?
No, they absolutely refused to talk to us. As Charlie said, we contacted the corporate headquarters, wrote to the CEO, asked for a meeting. And when we went there last Monday afternoon, we pulled into the parking lot, and just as we got out of our cars, before we could even walk across the parking lot 100 feet or so to the front entrance of the building, one of the vice presidents came running out and stopped us and would not let us go past. Well, we obviously could have forced our way past, but there was no point. But they were so adamant that they simply don't want to talk to us that they would not even let us come into the lobby or their building. And then he stood there and told us that, well, we know all the facts in the situation, and we're looking into it. And so I said, well, why don't you just go down there and talk to the people and see for yourself? Anybody who goes there can see that this is a horrible injustice. Well, he said, no, we have our lawyers working out. We don't have to do that. We can handle it. So they don't really want to know. They just simply refuse to know what is happening to the people that work in these factories. And they claim we're following the law. So they don't want to correct this terrible moral injustice. We hope that still through this pressure we're going to be able at some point to talk to the corporate leaders and appeal to their human decency and to their sense of concern for people, that they must have that someplace in their heart. And we'll see that simple people or ordinary good people like Gloria and Gladys and all the rest, that they deserve to have dignity and a chance to live a decent human life.
We had hoped to be joined by Cleveland Congressmember Sherrod Brown today, but he's in the midst of a health care forum in his district. Charles Kernighan, he was one of the people who came down to Nicaragua with you, and then when he returned, wrote a letter to President Clinton. Can you tell us what this is about?
Well, he wrote a letter to President Clinton, and surprisingly, in a single day, he had 68 members of Congress co-sign this letter. And Congressman Brown was deeply moved. We went to one of these houses the workers lived in, and it was put together virtually with plastic garbage bags and cardboard and scraps of wood. And he walked into the house, and he turned to us, and he says, "I can't believe it, that people making clothing for the largest retailers in the world are forced to live under these conditions." It turned out that worker who lived in the house worked for Chentex for 3 years, and she was fired last September because of her union activity. Her husband still worked 7 days a week for another of the Taiwanese-owned companies, and yet they had to live in a 10-foot by 10-foot plastic hut. So he's explaining this to President Clinton, the firings, the union busting, the barbed wire, and calling for an investigation. He also wrote to President Chen of Taiwan. So he came back really on fire and has done great work.
And how many people have signed on to the letter?
68 members of Congress have co-signed the letter. I mean, they're not going away. And they said they want to be with us on this Coles campaign. You know, it's very important to point out that this isn't a boycott. This isn't an attempt to hurt Coles financially, because we want those jobs to stay in Nicaragua. Gladys Arosa and the workers want those jobs. They need the jobs. But they need their human dignity and justice, too. So if Coles thinks it can pull out, they will be met by twice the campaign to put them right back in again. This is a demand for justice in the global economy. And like I said before, after Seattle, after Washington, the demonstrations at the IMF, this is it. This is the concrete face of the global economy. And it's one in which if workers stand up to even gain their most basic human rights, they're crushed and smashed. And these criminal charges, if they go through, really the message that's delivered is you take our jobs as the multinationals define them, and if you don't like it, you're going to go to jail. So this is incredible. This is incredible what's going on. This is a make or break situation.
If people want to get in touch with the National Labor Committee, where can they call or go on the web?
They could call us at 212 area code 242-3002, or they could go to our website at www.nlcnet.org. And we're going to have updates from Nicaragua on the website every day now through this campaign. It's that critical. So the workers are going back with a computer. They will be sending up daily updates on these criminal charges.
The campaign you led about against Kathy Lee Gifford's clothing line for Kmart. It was Kmart, right?
Walmart.
No, Walmart. It was Walmart. Yes. She's now leaving live with Regis and Kathy Lee. Do you feel like you made a difference in her case? Do you feel that the campaign has improved people's lives in the factories that made her clothes?
It has made a huge difference. It's made a difference in that it's educated the entire American people. Like, obviously, Kathy Lee Gifford didn't do this willingly. She was dragged into it kicking and screaming. But she played her role in fighting us and crying and threatening to sue and denying everything. As that was played out over those weeks and months, it educated the United States to sweatshops. This is a different country. Everyone knows child labor, starvation wages, sweatshops. Kathy Lee Gifford let the genie out of the bottle, and they can't get it back in again, so the companies are scrambling. But the real work now, I come back to it, these are workers who are trying to organize, and these are the cases we really need to work on. And so we're in this Coles campaign. Coles is going to be having openings on October 6th, another round of openings. We need to shut those openings down if Coles does not come to its senses. And the students are going to be doing actions on September 26th. So we're going to see a lot of work on the part of Unite, the steelworkers, the students, solidarity groups, religious groups. This is a widespread coalition.
Today you're meeting with Unite.
We're going up to Unite for a meeting this afternoon.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Charles Kernighan, head of the National Labor Committee for Human Rights, an independent human rights nonprofit based in New York. Barbara Briggs translating for Gladys Del Carmen Manzanares and Rosa Estelino Ocampo Gonzalez, who work with the Chentex Workers Union and Mil Colores Workers Union, both fired for their union activity in the free trade zones of Nicaragua as they take on the Kohl's department store chain that is growing by leaps and bounds in this country. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to another international issue. These days, international and national and local are very much meshed together. We're joined by several people to talk about the issue of what's been going on in Israel, the occupied territories, and Iraq because of events that have transpired over the last few days. Three Israeli soldiers died this weekend in a bungled attempt to arrest a Palestinian activist in the West Bank. The Israeli chief of staff suggested yesterday there'd been a serious operational mishap and said he could not rule out the possibility that the soldiers, members of an elite undercover unit, have been killed by friendly fire. In a minute, we're going to be joined by Robert Fisk, who's the Middle East correspondent for The Independent, and Phyllis Bennis in Washington, D.C., who will be talking about another issue that took place when arsonists struck a cultural center in a refugee camp near Bethlehem,
We're going to go to that refugee camp as well and find out the significance of this and what it has to do with the Middle East peace process, particularly the right of return. And also we'll be looking at Iraq and the latest news out of Iraq with, protests going on at the United Nations by some of the U.S. Security Council friends that are now splitting with the U.S. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, dealing first with the issue of the three Israeli soldiers who died this weekend in this bungled attempt to arrest a Palestinian activist in the West Bank. The Israeli government now saying it could be that the soldiers who were part of an elite undercover unit were killed by friendly fire. Israel says the troops were looking for Mahmoud Abu Hanoud, a leader of the Hamas movement. Israel says he's suspected of organizing two bombings in Jerusalem in 1997, which killed at least 26 people. Late on Saturday night, hundreds of Israeli soldiers entered Asira al-Shamalia, a village of 80,000 people. They sealed it off, imposed a curfew, conducted house-to-house searches. Villagers ignored the curfew, taking to the streets, while Israeli helicopters with searchlights circled overhead. Saturday's clash, the bloodiest for the Israelis in the West Bank since September of 1996, when nine soldiers were killed. Israeli troops continue to enforce a curfew on Asira yesterday. About 150 residents who'd been shut out waited to return to their homes. Robert Fisk, though you are in Beirut, you've been following the events in the occupied territory for the Independent of London, which you, for whom you're the Middle East correspondent. What is the latest? Robert Fisk, are you there?
I'm afraid your voice was so blurred there, I hardly picked you up. Could you try the question again?
Well, the question is, what is the latest on the three Israeli soldiers who were killed? Now the Israeli government saying it's possible that despite this crackdown...
Now, it's still unclear exactly how these soldiers died, although one should say that many of the blunders which the Israeli army has made over the past 10 years or so in fighting fundamentalists or activists, or as they like to call it, terrorists, have involved Israeli troops being killed by their own men. Indeed, it started in Lebanon more than a decade ago when four soldiers were shot dead in an orchard south of Tyre in an operation against people they referred to as terrorists, in which they killed only their own people. There was a shelling attack on a Shiite village 2 years ago, in which started brush fires in a wadi, which burned to death three Israeli soldiers. Again, what is known as friendly fire, or in the British parlance, an own goal. We've had several other incidents. For example, an Israeli attack into a Shiite village 5 years ago, in which three Israeli soldiers stormed into a building and were immediately blown up by booby-trapped bombs. And over again, what we've actually seen on the ground are attempts by so-called elite forces. And I believe the one last night was a special unit called Cherry, supposedly elite forces who have either been ambushed, blown up, or shot each other. The most obvious case was when 11 Israeli soldiers were killed in Lebanon 4 years ago, 3 years ago rather, when they followed a map which they believed to have been given to them by a collaborator, which supposedly showed a house in which Hezbollah members were meeting, members of the Hezbollah guerrilla movement. The Israelis intended to attack this house and were carrying explosives to blow it up. However, the map was a trap. The collaborator was actually working for the Hezbollah, and the Israelis were led inside Lebanon into a minefield. So again and again, we have supposedly expert elite forces turning their military operations into a fiasco.
And do you know anything about this particular undercover unit? Is it the Duv Divan?
No, this particular unit, Duv Divan means cherry, by the way, in Hebrew. This particular unit, I believe, has changed its name. It used to have a different name. Various Israeli operations are given different names in Lebanon, and the units concerned regularly change name in order to safeguard their previous operations. I'm sure these people have operated in Lebanon before. The real question is, why do they constantly blunder? Is it because they're not really elite forces, and this is part of the propaganda served up to the press and us, and indeed to their enemies, to make their enemies frightened of them? Or is there, in fact, a serious defect in the training of the Israeli army? Because it's very clear that the Israeli armed forces are capable of massive bombing, and indeed mass artillery fire, that it almost invariably, and this goes right back to 1982 and their invasion of Lebanon, invariably when they fight guerrillas, they lose.
Well, Robert Fisk, I want to thank you for that brief report speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon, as you cover issues of the Middle East. We're also joined on the telephone by Phyllis Bennis, who is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who just returned from the West Bank and Israel. In addition to this latest news, we have the news of burning down of a cultural center this week in the West Bank. Arsonists struck the Ibda Cultural Center at the Daisha refugee camp right near Bethlehem. It's a center where hundreds of children flock each day to exchange emails with children in other refugee camps. No one knows yet who's responsible for the burning. Phyllis, can you explain the significance of this attack?
Well, you know, Amy, on the one hand, this attack represented a serious blow, although one that will certainly be overcome, to the children who live in the overcrowded refugee camp Dehesha, where 11,000 Palestinian refugees live in less than one half a square kilometer. It's incredibly crowded. There's nothing for the children to do until this center was created. It includes a renowned and internationally renowned dance troupe. There's a computer center, there's a library, a nursery, a kindergarten, arts courses, a whole range of activities for over 800 children in the camp. So on the one hand, it was a real attack on the right of children, be they refugees, to have a real childhood. More significantly, I think, in terms of what likely motivated the arsonists, and it still isn't known who they were, Ibda and many of the refugees in and around Dehesha camp were emerging at the center of a newly energized movement of Palestinian refugees identifying themselves as refugees and demanding a renewed level of attention to the right of return, something that for many years among Palestinians had been more an idealized or romantic notion. Now, suddenly, with this third generation of refugees growing up in the camp, the kids in their late teens, young people in their 20s, these children and young people are now the ones that are starting to look much more realistically at what a right of return would look like. And it's something that presents serious problems for pretty much all the governments in the region, all the various forces who would love for the refugee issue to just go away. And the problem is that the refugees are not going away, and they're not giving up on their demanded right to return, as is required under international law and UN resolutions. And the Ibda Center at Dehesha, because it was known internationally, it had lots of international visitors. In fact, the very day before the fire on this past Friday, there was a team there from NBC News that was filming a special feature on the meeting of the Dehesha kids with their email pen pals and counterparts from the Shatila camp in Lebanon, a camp that's even in worse shape than Dehesha. The kids had managed to meet at the fence, at the Israeli border fence between Israel and Lebanon during that brief 10-day or 2-week period right after the Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon 2 months ago, when suddenly the border was reachable from both sides. And the adult organizers of the youth groups in both camps arranged to have the children meet for the first time. It was an extraordinary event. I saw a film of it while I was there, and watching these kids meeting each other for the first time and watching older people, including a brother and sister in their 70s, meeting for the first time in 52 years was an amazing thing. And the film of that was made possible by the IBDA Center. So all of that was very much the target of this this fire over the weekend.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, we are going to go to the Dehesha refugee camp now. Ziad Abbas is joining us, Abbas, who runs the IBDA Cultural Center. Can you tell us the latest? Welcome to Democracy Now! And can you tell us what you believe happened this weekend, how the center was set fire to, what you understand happened?
It was clear for us after we stopped the fire that some people, unknown people, attacked the center, and they attacked especially the computer center, which is the center for the internet. They took the server, which we have all the information about refugees and all our communications, especially with Shatila children in Lebanon. And after that, they destroyed all the centers and burned all the computers inside the center. After that, they destroyed the library, which this is the first library and the only library inside the Asia refugee camp for children, and destroyed it totally.
And do you have any idea who did it?
It's clear for us that the people, they are against refugees' rights, against our right of return, against development, against the smile of the children, against the future of the children in refugee camps.
Does the Middle East peace process, the recent Camp David meetings of Arafat, the Israeli leader, and President Clinton, do they have an effect on what goes on in Dehesha?
Absolutely. Well, our center is one of the active center in the whole West Bank concerning right of return and concerning refugees. And in the first 2 days of Camp David summit, we organized as IBDA Culture Center with our children a big demonstration in Bethlehem. And we were protesting against any compromise, against any conspiracy, which it will cancel or it will not deal with right of return for the Palestinian refugees.
And when you say right of return, what do you mean?
I am a human being. Just I want to feel equal like anyone in the world. I don't want anyone to force me where I should live. I want to live where I want, including my right to return to my destroyed village. This is the only way to live as a human being with dignity and equal like everyone. This is what means right to return for me as a refugee. Because I born in a refugee camp, I grew up in a refugee camp, I don't want to die in a refugee camp. And I am struggling now not to die in the refugee camp, and I don't want the children to have the same experience like me, living in and grow up and dying in the refugee camp. We are a human being, and we paid up from our life, 52 years waiting in refugee camp.
What are your plans now, Ziad Abbas, with IBDA, the cultural center that burned this weekend?
That's true. They destroyed the internet center, destroyed the communication, destroyed the library, but they destroyed things, walls, computers, books. They cannot destroy the idea. And as example, we had this project 2 weeks ago in the Dehesha refugee camp, and we took it as a new initiative by IBDA Culture Center to start to collect small funds from the families in the Dehesha refugee camp to transfer it to the Shatila children in Lebanon.
To collect small what?
To collect small funds just to continue to help our brothers and sisters living in Shatila refugee camp.
Funds.
Yesterday, despite all the bad conditions in Shatila refugee camp, Shatila children start collect money to send it to Dehesha to build the new internet center. And this will continue with this. This is in the beginning. And the other Saad will continue with all the people. They have solidarity with the Palestinian people from different countries in the world, and especially in USA, which people, they are very active to continue to have solidarity and to support the grassroots initiative inside refugee camps.
If people want to get in touch with the IBDA Center, where can they call or go on the web? Phyllis, maybe you can help us out here in the United States.
Well, the first thing that people can do who want to help rebuild the IBDA Center, a number of organizations are coordinating the fundraising. People can send checks, they are tax deductible, to the Middle East Children's Alliance. The address, and we can give it again at the end of the show perhaps, Amy, is 905 Parker Street, Berkeley, 94710. And just make
Berkeley,
out the
California,
check.
California, 905 Parker Street.
Right, and just make out the check to MECA, M-E-C-A, and identify it for the IBDA Rebuilding Fund.
I wanted to ask very quickly on another issue, but that it certainly has a profound impact on the Middle East. Iraq is saying now that it's going to forbid a newly trained UN weapons inspection team to enter the country. And I want to ask if the United States is now building to, do you think before the election there will be another, there are regular bombings of Iraq, but a whole, you know, a full-scale bombing?
There's a very serious danger of that, Amy. We don't know for sure. Right now it's appearing to me that neither party wants to put the issue of Iraq higher up on the agenda than it already is, for the simple reason that neither of them have a telegenic, easy solution that will end with the result they want to be able to brag about, which is the overthrow of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Short of that, I don't think they're going to be too eager. The problem is they have to figure out what they're going to do if indeed Iraq does what it says it has intended to do, which is to deny entry to the new arms monitoring agency, UNMOVIC. The Iraqis have said that until such time as the first steps towards lifting sanctions, not merely temporary suspensions, as is currently possible in the future, but the first steps towards lifting sanctions, then they would be willing to accept new arms inspectors. Short of that, they will not, and the U.S. then is faced with the question, if the Iraqi regime will not allow in new inspectors, is the U.S. prepared to maintain crippling economic sanctions that are slaughtering thousands of children and other vulnerable people every month, forever?
Phyllis Bennis, I want to give Bishop Gumbleton the last word. He was on with us for the first segment of the show talking about sweatshops. He's just returned from Nicaragua, but he has also spent time with Iraq and is deeply concerned about the issue of sanctions. Are you concerned about an escalation right now, Bishop Gumbleton, of hostilities toward Iraq, and what about the sanctions?
I'm definitely still very opposed to the sanctions. I think they are hurting all the wrong people, meaning killing the wrong people, and just doing devastation to the whole country. And I am concerned about what the U.S. may try to do during the next few months. We're caught in a dilemma. They, in one sense, the government does not really want President Hussein to go because Iraq could split up and they don't know what would happen then. On the other hand, they have made the statement they won't stop the sanctions until he's gone. So this leaves the people caught in the middle in a very cruel, unjust situation of dying and suffering, and it needs to stop as soon as possible.
The estimates on the number of children who die as a result of the sanctions are 5,000 per month. I want to thank you all for being with us, Phyllis Bennis, Institute Policy Studies, Bishop Gumbleton of Detroit, and Ziad Abbas, who runs the IBDA Cultural Center near Jerusalem, which was just burned this weekend, the Dehesha refugee camp near Bethlehem. That does it for the show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. It's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill. We had help from Deepa Fernandez. Matthew Finch is our engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Tomorrow, we will look at Nigeria and Chevron as President Clinton leaves the African country and heads off to Colombia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.